We almost finished chapter 7 last Wednesday, but didn't quite make it. We're down at the last few verses, a very, very familiar few verses, beginning with verse 24. And this is the last part of what we know of as the Sermon on the Mount, as Jesus finishes that up here in the last part of chapter 7, and then we continue in a different context in chapter 8. But reading the beginning of verse 24, Jesus said, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." So it was when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as one of the scribes. So this very familiar, these very familiar verses about the house built on the rock and the house built on the sand, I suspect all of us back in our early days in Bible class remember the song, and we went through the motions of it. The wise man built his house on the rock, and the foolish man. I'm not going to sing it for you, by the way, so don't start cringing. But and we've been taught that story from a very early age. And Jesus' point here is that we should be building to withstand the storms. And here he made a parallel at the end of this Sermon on the Mount between storms and buildings. And here in the South, we're all familiar with that. We're familiar with occasions such as this. Not necessarily rock and sand, but the devastation that can be brought about by storms. And here he's encouraging people, I think, to act upon his teachings up until this point. And he contrasts the difference here between those who are doers and those who were listeners, as he talked about earlier in the chapter. And Ryan made reference to that, to those same verses in his lesson on Sunday. But here in this particular lesson, we want to look at just a couple of points here about the houses and the storms and how we build on these things. And I would submit to you, first of all, that the houses he's talking about here represent our lives. Each of us is building a life, and we're building these lives upon a foundation. And this foundation may be a philosophy, it may be a doctrine adopted from others, it may be some philosophy that we've developed ourselves, or it may be a foundation based upon the Word of God. And so we cannot escape the fact that we're builders. We can't say, no, I choose not to build. That's a necessity. The question is whether we'll be wise or foolish builders, and the tests that are going to determine whether we're wise builders or foolish builders, those things are called storms, and that's what he has reference to here. And these storms may be literal storms that present themselves to us. They may be figurative. We run into all sorts of things in our time of building a life. We have illnesses. We lose loved ones. We have financial setbacks. We have things that may take away our health, things that may take away family, things that may take away our possessions. And we recall Job and the things that happened to him. All of these were storms. And then there's that final storm that's the final storm of death and the final day of judgment. And the Lord is going to describe to us on that day what kind of builder or what kind of servant we have been. And that description will come in the form of, "Well done, good and faithful servant," or, "You wicked and slothful servant." There will be one of two designations that the Lord will determine on that day. So the longer we live, the more storms that we're going to face, and then we're going to face that final storm. and that final storm that none of us will escape. And so the point that the encouragement for us today is that we should be those wise builders, building upon the foundation of a rock. And I would submit to you that rock is Jesus Christ, that we should build on. Questions or comments on those points? And we could take these few verses and develop a number of lessons just on those themselves. But any questions or comments anyone would like to make before we look at the letter? Last, Larry?
Paul goes through what you've just gone through again in 1 Corinthians, the 3rd chapter. And he talks about them building on that foundation and that's what the apostles were doing. Because it says in the verse, anyway, other foundation can no man lay than that which is laid, which is Christ Jesus. So it makes this here in Matthew very clear what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Give your foundation. How you build on it will determine how your life
goes
and how that final storm.
And for us, there's two variables there. What's our foundation going to be? It can be some of these things that I mentioned, or it can be Jesus Christ. And then, if that's our foundation, how are we going to build on that? And those two things are going to determine what his final decision will be after our death. Anyone else? Jimmy?
I was just thinking, we talked a little bit about Jesus dispensing relationship advice and how foolish we would be not to heed advice from our Creator who designed us to have these relationships. I mean, that's the best source to go to when you look for relationship advice. It's the same thing with this idea. We're all impressed with folks that can build. I know I am. And I can nail a couple boards together, and that's what you're going to have is two boards that are nailed together. But there are people that know what they're doing when it comes to building, and when they're done, it's amazing what they've accomplished. So when we start thinking about foundations and how to build, I mean, where else to look than the person, the entity who built it all, who built, framed this world that we live in? You know, we're foolish if we look for advice somewhere else on where to build our foundation. He is the subject matter expert on everything, whether it's relationships or, you know, building a foundation for our lives, you name it. And that's what this is all about, is to say, you can choose whichever one you want, but you'd be awfully foolish to choose anything other than the Word of God.
Right. Anything you choose other than that is, in his example here, it's the sand. And that building's going to come crashing down when the storms come. In the last couple of verses here, in chapter 7, he says, and so it was when Jesus had ended these sayings, and here he ended this, as we know of as the Sermon on the Mount, that the people were astonished at his teaching. And I would suspect not only just the people in general, I think his disciples were astonished at that. They were, I think, throughout his ministry, Jesus' disciples were constantly astonished at the things that he did, because they viewed them as some, these are not things that they saw every day. They weren't things that anyone saw every day, and certainly they didn't. They said the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as having authority and not as one of the scribes. Now, that's just Jesus' teaching. It wasn't that he had to call on these higher powers and a lightning bolt came crashing down when he was talking. It was his manner of teaching and the authority that he exhibited. Said he taught as one having authority. Now, they had been taught, or the Jews especially, had been taught by the scribes. But the scribes were passing something along. Jesus taught as one having authority, the authority coming from himself. And so that's a distinction, I think, that is made here. He taught as one having authority. He spoke as one that had the right to make the law, and he did that. Questions or comments on chapter 7 before we move forward? In chapter 8, we're going to note two different things here, and one comes in the middle of all the others, but that I think we need to consider. First, the nature and the purpose of the miracles that Jesus performed. And we're going to talk about five in particular, and then there we're told a host of others. We don't know specifics about those, but we'll talk about five in particular. And the second thing that we'll spend some time on in chapter 8 will be the cost of discipleship. And this is something that I think quite often we overlook when we're teaching somebody the truth, that there is a cost that comes with being a disciple of our Lord. And it's not something that you can just sort of go with the flow and you don't have to do very much, just sort of lay back and take it easy. That's not the point that Jesus is making here. And so the cost of discipleship is something that he addresses here in the middle of this chapter. Let's read the first several verses here of chapter 8. It says, "When he had come down from the mountain, great multitudes followed him. And behold, a leper came and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean.' Then Jesus put out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' Immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, 'See that you tell no one, but go your way. Show yourself to the priests and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them.'" A couple of things we might note here. First of all, Jesus could have unilaterally healed this man of his leprosy. He could have just seen him there, a leper, and just said, "Be cleansed," and he would have been. But what other thing do we see here in this example of him healing the leper, other than what Jesus did? What do we see that was very important? Okay, the faith of this man. The faith of this man who had been stricken with this dreadful disease of leprosy. Because he said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." And Jesus healed him, but his faith allowed that to happen. He said, "See that you tell no one, but go your way. Show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Why did this man have to do that? Because they were under the law. Jesus obeyed the law. Jesus lived under the law. And this man was living under the law. So what did he have to do? Show yourself to the priest. Offer the gift that Moses commanded. Whatever the sacrifice is that you have to offer, do that as a testimony to them. But he said at the beginning, "See that you tell no one." Why did Jesus tell him that? Was that something he consistently throughout his ministry always said? Okay, here early on, and you know, we can speculate, but Jesus was not ready for this to be just made known to anyone and everyone. His time had not come, if you will, at this particular point, even though he was performing miracles. And he had taught already as one having authority. But he said, "See that you tell no one." What happened? I don't know that I read everyone, but what happened every time he healed someone or performed a miracle and he said, "Don't tell anybody"? What happened every time? They went and told somebody, told a lot of people. But his point was, again, that he wasn't ready for all that to be revealed. And so we're not told in this particular case what this man did, but that happened almost without fail when he did that. The second occasion we look at said, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." Centurion answered and said, "Lord, I'm not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word, and my servant will be healed." That's amazing. "For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to those who followed, assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. We'll skip a couple of verses and then come back. In verse 13, Jesus said to the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour. Jesus was willing to go to this man's house and heal his servant. But he said, I'm not worthy of that. Maybe your time is so important, you don't need to spend that time doing that for me. All you have to do is just say the word. And Jesus said, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. This man was not a Jew. This man was a Gentile. And I'm assuming he was a centurion. I'm assuming he was a Roman. And Jesus said, not even in Israel. I hadn't found this kind of faith in Israel, much less in a Gentile. A Roman soldier had this kind of faith. And he said, as you have believed, so let it be so, or so let it be done to you. And his servant was healed that same hour. Seth?
I want to ask this question while you're teaching, and not when it's my turn up there.
Well, I'll mark it down. Every one you ask me, I'm going to ask you.
So when Jesus says, I will come and heal him, for Jesus to enter the house of the Gentile, he would have become unclean. For Jesus to touch a leper, he would have become unclean. For Jesus to touch, to raise someone from the dead, to touch someone, did Jesus become unclean? Or what are your thoughts around this subject?
I'm thinking no, let me back up. If he did, we're not given any information about what he did according to the law to become clean again. And I would think if he had taken any steps, if he had been unclean as a result of that, something would have been said that said, so he went to the priest or he did this, or he did that. And that's not the case. Now, if your next question is why or why didn't he, I don't know that. I've always thought in those cases that he did not. You know, looking at another occasion, totally separate from this, you know, they ask him, why don't your, we've already dealt with this, but why don't you and your disciples fast? And he told them why. And there are occasions where he explained that, why he didn't do things a certain way. You know, when they came in, they ate of the showbread, or they went through the fields and they took the grain on the Sabbath day, and they ate of that. Many times they accused him of blasphemy when he did certain things. But in about healing, is it not better for me to say, arise, take up your bed and walk, or be healed? And so how does that not fit the law? I don't know, because like I said at the beginning, Jesus lived under the law. And he faithfully kept the law. Why the exception there? I just can't answer that. I may have some chauffeurs out there that can answer that question.
Somebody else. I know that he seems to do things to almost antagonize the scribes and Pharisees that are among him.
Yeah.
At times, and I almost wonder if some of these are for that purpose, to get them to think.
That could well be. Anyone else have a? Yes, Nathan.
If he had become unclean, couldn't he just cleanse himself? He's Jesus, right? I mean, he raised a person from the dead, and so whatever part of him is unclean, well, then he could just cleanse him.
Yeah, and my thinking on that is that, like you said, he's Jesus. He's the Son of God, and he could do things that others couldn't. He could do things that for others they would have to, like this leper, had to go to the priest to get things done. So that's a sufficient justification for me also. Someone, Stacy.
I mean, I think if you became unclean doesn't necessarily mean that you were in sin.
He went to Zacchaeus' house, yeah.
He goes out to places where, you know, does he become unclean? We also kind of look at what are things that the scribes and Pharisees are putting upon the children of Israel that may not be something that's against the law necessarily, but it is what the scribes are coming to him saying, why are you doing such a thing? Because they feel it is a violation, at least of the traditions.
Right.
It may not actually be a violation of the law.
Because we know at this particular point, The law of Moses hadn't changed, but their application of the law of Moses down at this point in the early life of Jesus had changed significantly from what it was originally. But back to your original point, you're absolutely right. He, even if he did become unclean under the law, he did not sin. We know that. It was not sinful. And even for the Jews, if they became unclean in a certain way, now it could have involved sin, but it didn't have to. And so certainly with Jesus, we know that he did not sin. So whatever might have happened that might have caused him to be unclean, or maybe some thought he was unclean, it was not sinful on his part. That answer your question, Seth? Not mine totally, but yeah, we'll get there. Yes, sir. Yeah.
And they took it to a further extreme, which he's told them about multiples of times.
Yeah.
And that you alluded to a moment ago. So I really don't think personally that the law shows anything in there that a Jew just having contact with a Gentile would make them unclean. You would, if you touch a leper, yes, obviously that.
Yeah, that's one that is specified. And I'm convinced that having read some of the, not just in recent weeks, but some of the details in the accounts of Josephus, some of the things that the Jews in Jesus' time had done with the law, very likely they made some things unclean that were never meant to be as part of the law. And so they had changed it considerably at this particular point. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Jewish
Absolutely. And to me, especially this case with this centurion, that that he was amazed at such great faith would be found in a Gentile, not even one in Israel, I think. And the other, of course, significant also, but both those cases, it mentions it. That, and we might think, well, if he created, why is he amazed, or how is he amazed? But he was on those two occasions. Larry, yeah.
In Hebrews 5th chapter, in verse 5, so also Christ glorified not himself to be made a high priest, but he that said unto him, thou art my son, today have I begotten thee as a high priest. And saith in another place, thou art the priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Yeah. Christ himself was a priest according to what God said.
Absolutely. While not a Levitical priest, like you said, he was high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And no less a high priest, he was not a Levitical priest, but he was no less a priest in that particular context.
He was able to offer things to God that other people could
not. Yes.
I tend to think that puts him in a special spot as a representative of God.
Yes. Okay, good point. Okay.
Bruce, I like to think that Jesus was made unclean, whether it's true or not, I'm not sure. Just because he chose to put himself in that place, he chose to make himself unclean to make this other person clean and bring themselves in the right state. Just like sacrificing himself, he chose to put on my sin to make me clean. And I just love that analogy that he did it for these people, yeah. He did it for me too.
Good point, and that very well may be the case. And as has been pointed out, he wasn't a Levitical priest, but he was a priest, and he could perform all the duties of a priest himself. Good point. Yes?
In Leviticus 14, the priest actually did touch the lepers, and they went into the houses of lepers to see if there was leprosy in the house. So the Bible says the priest did touch them.
Then he could do that. Okay, hadn't thought about that. Matt. Good point. Let's back up and look at, it seems almost to some, just on quick reading, it seems like verses 11 and 12 were sort of a parenthesis in what Jesus was saying here, that he just all of a sudden sort of went off to the side and made this statement, and then he went on back to the centurion servant. But let's read those. He said, "And I say to you," after he said, "I've not found such great faith, not even in Israel," he said, "And I say to you that many will come from east and west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." The point I think that Jesus is making here, he just witnessed and talked about how he marveled at this. This such great faith from this Roman centurion, this Gentile. And then he goes into this and he says, many will come from east and west and sit down with Isaac and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Who are the many from the east and west that he was talking about? The Gentiles, okay? And he says, but the sons of the kingdom, who are they? The Jews. So he's making that point, and he's referring back to what just happened with this Roman centurion. He said, they will sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the sons of the kingdom will be cast into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So there would be Gentiles who would be saved, and there were going to be Jews who were going to be lost, because they didn't, the Gentiles were going to be saved because they did the will of the Father. And the Jews were going to be lost because they did not do the will of the Father, just as we read over in verses 19 through 21 earlier in the chapter. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father. So his point here, this Roman centurion will do my will, and there are going to be Israelites who will not do my will. Other questions? Bryce?
The centurion had a knowledge of who Jesus was, even though the Jews were supposed to be the ones who knew who he was or who were looking for him. And he says, I'm not worthy of you coming to my home. And then he says, I also am a man of authority. So I believe he's recognizing that Jesus has some authority. It's not his governor. He's got some supreme authority. And then one of the things I think he marvels about is, you know, this guy talks about some things that he as a boss would do. He tells his people that work under him, go do this, and those are real easy things. But the fact that he recognized that Jesus could have that same ease of authority over something that was miraculous like that, to me, is one of the things I think he had to marvel about, because we have a lot of accounts of Jesus working miracles. He had probably heard some stories about
it. Oh, I'm sure.
Hadn't seen it. And he out of that knowledge, he had that level of faith to know that Jesus was probably God, ultimately, whether he knew to that extent or not. But that seems to be the way I read it.
Yeah, I think obviously from what we read here that he had some prior knowledge. I don't know that, because this is says when he had entered Capernaum. And we don't have any evidence here that this Roman centurion witnessed his healing of the leper. And so, obviously, I think he had some knowledge about who Jesus was. He recognized his authority, and he called him Lord. He said, I'm not willing to come. I'm not worthy that you should come. I'm not willing for you to come, that you should come under my roof, but all you have to do is speak a word. So he knew that Jesus could perform miracles. He knew that Jesus was, like you said, he knew that Jesus was Lord. And even though he recognized that he had authority, like you say, that he could tell people to do this and do that, come here, go there, and they would follow those instructions. But Jesus was much higher than that. The centurion never presumed that he could heal someone who was as ill as this servant was. He was lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented, and he recognized that Jesus could heal this man, and he could heal him not by going to him and laying hands on him. That's what Naaman expected to happen. But he didn't expect Jesus to do that. He said, all you have to do is say the word. Just say a word, and he'll be healed. And not such great faith, not even in Israel. Then, beginning in verse 14, said, when Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother lying sick with a fever. So he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and served them. When evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, he himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses. In the few minutes we have left, I want to look at these next few verses this cost of discipleship. So when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. Then a certain scribe came to him and came and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Then another of his disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." So here in the second case, the first case, I think we understand Jesus is telling this scribe that this is not an easy road. Discipleship to me it's not going to be easy. And he said, I don't have any place to lay my head. I don't have a house to live in. And I'm just going here and there. And this is a very difficult path that you're going to take. Now, we're not told if that scribe followed up with what he said. That's all we know, because he said, "I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus told him what was going to happen, and I sort of have a feeling that he sort of was like the rich man, that he had these great possessions and he went away sorrowful because he wasn't willing to give all those things up. But then another disciple said, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." Jesus said, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." Looking at that, someone might think, "Well, Lord, isn't that pretty cruel? All this man wants to do is go bury his father. And you say, let the dead bury the dead." Was Jesus really being that cruel to this young man? I think the lesson here for us is that, and I want to read a few verses, and our time's going to run out, relative to this. In Luke chapter 14, verses 25 and 26, Jesus said, "Now great multitudes went with him," Jesus, "and he turned and said to them, 'If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple.'" And then in Matthew chapter 10, 34 through 37, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." So Jesus is not saying you, and I think the word hate here means to love less. He's not saying you're supposed to hate your mother and hate your father and hate your son and hate your daughter, but you are to love them less than you love me. Get your priorities straight. The Lord has to come first. All these things come second. And he even said that about his own family when he was told over in Matthew chapter 12 that his mother and brothers were outside wanting to speak to him. He said, Who's my mother and who are my brothers? There are all these people here. And so he didn't, I don't know if he went on and spoke to them or not, but that these responsibilities of discipleship are more important than familial responsibilities. And that's the point he was making here about let the spiritually dead go and bury their own physically dead. But get your priorities straight. Other comments? We'll finish up. Look at the last miracle that Jesus performed there in chapter 8, and hopefully complete chapter 9 next Wednesday. And then the following Wednesday, Seth is going to pick up with chapter 10. Thank you for your comments and attention.